across the galaxy and into your dwelling. It's the Smuggler's Dispatch, a podcast that explores every corner of the Star Wars universe.
All right, pal. Here it is, my own family's blend of black calf. I hope you enjoy it.
Ooh. Mmm, it's herbal.
Yeah, there's actually just a little tinge of spice in there. And so I think that that's what, I mean, it's not illegal, but it's not legal. And so with this stuff, don't tell everybody about it. But
your family's in this too, you said? Like their ashes, your dead mother Myrtle.
Mother Myrtle. Myrtle Gamora Khan, yes. She's
she's a tasty one.
Immortalized. I thought, what is the best way to use her ashes? And I thought, this cup of black calf is
a cup
perfect.
Of calf.
So with that, maybe we should get this transmission rolling. What do you say?
Let's do it.
Okay, I'm going to hit the button here. All right, going live in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hello and welcome back to another episode of The Smuggler's Dispatch, a podcast where we explore every corner of the Star Wars galaxy one topic at a time. I'm Alex Stewart.
And I'm Michael Howarth. And Al, today we are talking about a duchess, the most famous duchess of all.
Yes, even more famous than a Swiss Miss, if you will. I think, so real quick, for any backstories, for anybody who's just jumping into the Smuggler's Dispatch on this podcast episode, the previous episode that we talked about, we were covering the planet of Mandalore, which then essentially led us into the conversation about the Mandalorian people. And we understood that we need to explore some of the most popular and well-known icons of Mandalorian culture to be able to understand the civilization better. And each one of these following three episodes that we have on the podcast are going to be covering each one of those notable figures. And we are starting with the Duchess with the Muchess, which is...
To know her is to love her. Satine
Kryze.
Yeah.
So real quick, listener, before we dive in, first, as you can tell, this is a little bit more of a laid-back epi. We're not necessarily going out on an adventure or anything like that. We're just sitting here in the galley of the Raven 5, just sipping on some black calf and just having a conversation, because obviously there are no cantinas anywhere on Mandalore that we can tell. So we can't do a casual cantina episode, but we wanted these episodes to be a character study that is more conversational in nature. We're not necessarily going to go into the history of the creation of these characters or of their backstory or anything like that. Well, but I should say there is going to be backstory conversation with this. So if you're not into spoilers, then before we get started on this episode, you're going to want to watch all of the Clone Wars and all of Rebels. And all of the Mandalorian series.
No big deal.
Go ahead and pause and welcome back.
Take 3 months out of your life and go do all of that and then come back to this episode.
So hopefully that's a good call out though. Hopefully you now that you're back from that journey, you have good hygiene. Yeah. And you practice good hygiene that whole time in health. And let's talk about Satine. Michael, I want you to kind of lead the front on this Satine conversation, because I don't know a lot about Satine, and you're kind of the resident Satine bean.
The Satine bean. I don't know about that, but let's talk about Satine. We have a little bit of structure here, but mostly we're just going to talk. Which is what we always do anyway. We have a little bit of structure, exactly. We just talk. But yeah, so Satine Kryze, the Duchess of Kalevala, which I actually didn't know this. I thought she was just the Duchess of Mandalore, but Kalevala is the planet in the Mandalore system that she is the Duchess of, which is the homeworld of the Kree's family and the Kree's clan. So I guess there was like a political Kree's that was kind of like when they had ruling families, and then there was the clan of the Kree's when it's more of like the older Mandalorian like warrior culture clan. So there's, it gets complicated fast, honestly. I was reading some Wikipedia and things get convoluted. But
I do think
the Duchess of Mandalore.
I think one of the things that's interesting about that is when you look at culture, I had the fun opportunity to be able to go back to the old country with my family, i.e. Scotland, because we are of Scottish heritage. And when we were over there, we learned a lot about our clan of Scottish people, which is the Stuart clan. And it's interesting to see that a clan is essentially a proto rulership, a proto empire, a proto monarchy of sorts.
Yeah.
And so it would make sense that this starts as a clan being something that is a lot less defined and refined. And when it moves into a system of royalty with her having the title of Duchess, it kind of follows through that beautiful heritage that we have, that we can already draw from as human beings. So I think that's kind of cool.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know much about clans and peoples and Scotland and all that good stuff. Yeah. But that's interesting. We'll have to talk more about that sometime, Al. But yeah, she is the Duchess of Kalevala and Mandalore, and a
Can
member
I ask
of
you a
the
question?
Kree's family. Yeah, what's up?
Mandalore system. We hear all the time about I'm wanted in six systems.
Yeah, exactly.
How do we explain systems? Are systems a grouping of planets or a planet with moons? Moon?
I think it's all of the above. I think it can be any, because we have the Hoth system that we hear referred to a lot. We have the Mandalore system. There's
the
a
Dagobah
lot of places.
System.
The Dagobah system. Yeah, I mean, I think what it boils down to is there's a planet where the main story is happening on. It has a name, and they just call it the system. And then later, it is populated with more planets if more stories are going to happen there. And if there's moons and things like that, you know, we got the moons of Yavin, things like that. I think celestial bodies. Let's just go with that. A grouping of celestial
bodies. Okay, because I've always wondered how they categorize a system.
Yeah.
In Star Wars, because I mean, it's all just a galaxy. I mean, are they, maybe a system is like what we've got, our solar system. So
that's,
it's
probably
like,
true. Yeah.
It's like a grouping of all of our planets. Ooh. Together. Our solar system. Does our solar system on Earth have a name? Do you know?
I don't know. That's a good question.
That is something I've never thought about.
I was going to say like the Milky Way, but we look at the Milky Way.
Exactly.
So we're not in it. I don't know. What was that? Wasn't there like a really cool picture of that eyeball looking thing from the James Webb telescope? It was like is it called like the Eye of God or something? It's like a really cool celestial body as well.
I mean, our solar system it's a really fancy name. It's called the solar system.
Oh, nice.
So that's all. Oh, look at that. The Eye of God, the Eye of Sauron.
Yes. Oh, man. We are bullet point number one. We cannot stay on track. This is rough business.
I just thought that was an important question to ask because
great.
We
no,
hear
no,
system
Al,
all
no,
the
you're
time.
Great. You're right. You're not getting off track. That
do you know how many planets are in the Mandalore system?
I don't. I'm gonna guess three. How many?
Okay. All right, that sounds. No, I that wasn't.
We'll
a, that wasn't.
A,
yeah, I was just asking. I wasn't. That wasn't like a setup for a trivia. That wasn't a triviata.
So, I mean, there's the one where Bo-Katan has her castle that she sits in like an emo girl alone. Uh-huh. There is. Let's see. There's Mandalore that's just totally glassed over the main planet. So that would be Kalevala. Yeah, I'm gonna say three.
Wait, so Kalevala is the main planet?
I think so.
I thought the main planet was Mandalore. Mandalore is a planet.
This is killing me. See, it's confusing. Okay, this is something else.
And we're looking at Finnish history right now.
That's the real world Finnish history, yeah, which is really interesting. I got sucked into that Wikipedia page.
Kalevala Koru? Yeah, I'm wondering if I'm saying bad words in other languages right now.
Is a terrestrial planet in the Mandalore system. Within the sector of the honor, it's a homeworld of House Kryze. I mean, maybe that's not it.
No, Mandalore. So, late, go down, because look, goodness. It says that it's part of Mandalore.
Right, the system.
Like, sun is the Mandalore. What? Sun is the Mandalore? The name of the sun in this thing is Mandalore, but then when
Mandalore
you look at it...
Mandalore is... Wait, what is this picture?
What the heck? Yo, we are gooey.
Is a star. Mandalore is the yellow star of the Mandalore system.
What?
Fandom trivia. How well do you know Mandalore? Apparently
we
not
don't
that
know
well.
It well at all.
Oh, man. It's so confusing.
I am almost positive that the planet is Mandalore.
I'm willing to believe you. I think we can just lay that down as headcanon. Mandalore sector, Mandalore
Yes,
system.
Mandalore Wait, is it, a planet. That's what we're floating above Mandalore. Right now. What we're looking down on right now is the planet known as Mandalore.
Okay. Yes. Without the luscious green and any of the goodness.
Y'all, you cannot expect us to be astrophysicists here, all right? We are not Star Wars version of Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, exactly.
So she's a ruler of one of the planets in the system, not the main planet of Mandalore.
Right. Yeah. That's like her original, the actual title she holds is for that Kalevala system. But that does change eventually within her story. So, So as we saw on Google, it's named after a collection of oral epic poetry from Finland, which is kind of interesting. I don't know if that was on purpose at all. The planet Kalevala, but this oral, poetry that's collected in this book is actually like it's kind of keeping their narrative culture from Finland alive, like their historical oral narratives, which I thought was kind of interesting because keeping culture alive is a big part of Mandalore's history as well. So that may just be a coinky dink.
I think that also describes Satine's role because she is trying to. Oddly enough, she's trying to keep the culture alive through, how do I say this? Through hampering the thing that gives the culture its identity, which is by making it peaceful and not a warring culture.
Yeah.
Because it is a warring culture by nature, but she realizes that in order to perpetuate and keep the society going, they have to no longer have that as their main tenant of their identity. That's deep and confusing.
As everything is here. I thought that was interesting. When Satine grew up in the Mandalore system, she actually saw the grasslands of Mandalore before the wars destroyed it. So that must have been nice. I imagine her like Russell Crowe in Gladiator, kind of like running her hands through space
through
wheat
the wheat
as she's heading home. Okay,
that's
cool.
A great scene in Gladiator, by the way.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of grass, she became the grassroots leader of the new Mandalorians following the Mandalorian Civil War. So basically the Mandalorians just keep fighting each other, they keep destroying the planet, they have these clan battles all the time, and as the planet begins to get more and more destroyed over time, more Mandalorian people begin seeing the value in potentially not living out the way that they have for millennia as a community of warriors, as a planet of warriors, and start looking towards a peaceful life to keep their planet alive. And that's kind of, that's what the new Mandalorians are, that group. And Satine was a part of that group, and naturally through her powers and her abilities as a leader, she just kind of rose through the ranks of that group of the new Mandalorians during the Mandalorian Civil War.
Which I've got to say, that is just begging to be a band name. The New Mandalorians.
The New Mandalorians.
I would love that. Maybe I'm going to be part of that band.
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah, it'd be super dope.
So traditionally Mandalore, for those who weren't listening to our previous episode, Mandalore is a culture of warriors.
Yes.
And it was kind of known for, I mean, really, when warriors don't have anything else to do, they start to fight each other and fight themselves. And that's exactly what was happening here. And Satine saw that that was going to be the end of the line. And like we talked about in the previous episode, this is actually in the middle of the action. I should say in the middle of this period where Mandalore is going through a time of pacifism. And that's what surprised Dave Filoni when he and George Lucas started developing the Mandalorian stories in the Clone Wars, is Dave Filoni was ready to just start having all these space battles with all these blood-hungry Mandalorians. And George Lucas came in and was like, well, actually, they put down their arms.
Yep.
One day I'm going to win an award. People are going to hire me to do voiceover for George Lucas.
George Lucas impersonator. I'd be honored. That's like George with a cold, maybe. With a bit of a head cold. A little bronchitis.
I'm going to perfect it.
So the destruction of the planet in the Mandalorian Civil War is a little bit prior to and during the Clone Wars as well. So this civil war kind of turns into a cold war eventually, but there were battles between these reformist new Mandalorians and the Mandalorian warriors of tradition, which is kind of ironic because the new Mandalorians are all about peace and pacifism, but they still end up fighting a war against the people attached to the olden days, which causes even more destruction. And I think this was before Satine really dug into a pure pacifist view. Because after that, seeing continued destruction, she was like, no, not at all. We are absolutely going to be pacifists moving forward. And her father was actually killed in those Mandalorian civil wars. And her father was the Duke of Mandalore. So he had actual power. Like through royalty, through the monarchy or whatever. And she was his successor. So she had climbed the ranks from a grassroots perspective in the new Mandalorians. And then when her father died, she also had the technical mantle of Duchess. So she was definitely in the eye of the storm for being the leader of Mandalore. And also totally driven to be completely pacifist, especially after the death of her father, which was obviously going to be a difficult road leading the planet of Mandalore with the history that they had.
Now, one pregunta I have, which is pregunta? Spanish for question.
Ooh.
I'm doing Duolingo. Going through Duolingo.
With that mean
one question
owl.
That... Yeah, you've been gone for 3 days. What's wrong? when we study the royal structure, a duchess is not a king or a queen, and usually the king or the queen is the ruler. And that's one thing that I find really interesting here is that she's a duchess, yet we see no king or queen around. And so that's just something that I've always been... Because I think a duke and a duchess oversee a smaller province of the larger kingdom. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think so. And maybe because the system of Mandalore is a collection of planets. And
you should look what the meaning of duke and duchess is.
Dude, I just looked up duchess, and this is my favorite informal British, especially among the Cockneys, an affectionate form of address used by a man to a girl or woman he knows well. Spotted a likely one, Duchess.
Spotted a likely one, Duchess. Oh, yeah, it's going to be real nice.
Yeah, that's the example. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, that's why I am curious, because I always thought that the Duchess was somebody who oversaw one of the smaller... areas. Yes, it a sovereign ruler over a small state in continental Europe called a duchy?
A duchy. I think it's a duchy.
Okay. In the British monarchy, Avicii.
Oh, man. The Duke is the highest hereditary title outside of prince, princess, king, or queen. Yeah, it just sounds cooler, you know?
Oh, so it is right below king and queen. So yeah. Maybe her dad, was her dad a duke? Or was her dad a king?
I don't know how deep the rabbit hole goes.
I'm pretty sure that a duke and a duchess are like the relatives, the siblings of a king and queen. This is the thing. Really, when you look at this, Satine is a very important character for what she does. Yeah. But I don't think that any of the Star Wars universe stories have really done her justice to actually make her more of a dynamic character. Because, I mean, let's jump into the Clone Wars. Realistically, yes. When we encounter Satine for the first time, we yeah. see that she is a ruler who is empowered. We see
yeah,
that
she's
she
established.
Is, yeah, that she is a ruler, but she's also not she's not a weak character. She
no.
is a solid main character who has a good trajectory, but yeah. not a lot of development happens on her as a character. She herself creates development in characters like Obi-Wan yeah. and in
yeah.
Bo-Katan.
And in Bo-Katan, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But standing alone, she doesn't get a lot of development in the Clone Wars, and I don't think anywhere outside of the Clone Wars does she, that I can think of.
So there is a little bit in Master and Apprentice where we learn about Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon's adventures on Mandalore protecting her. It's not a story set within that time, but it's them talking about the experiences they had then. So yeah, a lot of her history is already kind of set, and we don't explore that within the stories. You're totally right. But it's also a classic Star Wars move with a character like this, which gives her such richness, is we are dropped into the middle of this. So when she's introduced, we are introduced to her through the lens of Obi-Wan Kenobi in the Clone Wars. So basically, Obi-Wan has returned to Mandalore to help protect this Duchess, and we are introduced to her character, and we see that, first of all, right off the bat, that her and Obi-Wan have a lot of history together. They knew each other super well. There's even a bit of a little romantic spark between the two of them. We know that she is an established leader. We know that her views are very progressive for the planet and upset a lot of their population. So it's like there's so many things that we just are led to, that we have to assume about her, that we're told about her when we're dropped into it, which I like that. I think that's really fun.
Yeah.
But like you enjoy, Al, that gives us the opportunity to experience more stories about what brought her to that point.
Well, and that's what I think is really interesting is this being a character study, as we will be doing with Bo-Katan and we will be doing with Din Djarin in these next episodes. We see that really the purpose, and I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast, but when I teach my students story structure in my film class, and in story writing in general, one of the things that you see in our secondary characters is a secondary character of a story falls basically into two subcategories in secondary characters. You've got driver characters and you've got filler characters. And driver characters are those characters who are not the main character of the story, but without their presence and their actions and their existence, the story would cease to exist the way that it is. Mm-hmm. And so in a lot of ways, these secondary driver characters are absolutely critical to the telling of the story, yet they're not necessarily served by the main story. Therefore, they get a little bit of second-class treatment in that way. And I
right.
think that Satine falls into this category of being a secondary driving character who brings growth to an entire system and brings growth to the main character of Obi-Wan Kenobi, because we get to see the humanity of Obi-Wan Kenobi through Satine and he's, it's not even an, like a, an undertone of romance. The reality is, Obi-Wan Kenobi makes it very clear that if Satine had asked, he would have left the Jedi Order for her.
Right.
And he says that in the series.
Yeah. Yep.
And so I think that with a character like Satine, the interesting thing on a character study with her is with a character that is a secondary driver, you almost study the characters around them to get a better understanding of them as a character, which is really a heady intellectual concept if you think about it from a story writing perspective.
Right.
And
well,
I don't
and,
know.
And as a secondary character, they don't have to evolve. They don't, their character arc does not have to be as complete because she is kind of established. Like, she's not dealing with moral, you know, quandaries. She knows exactly where she stands, and she's extremely firm in that. So her character doesn't change much, but the world around her is forced to change and pushes back against her, which makes her really interesting.
Yes, and one thing that I'm trying to remember is, do we see the death of Satine Kryze in Star Wars?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Remind me of that, because I don't remember her death.
It's like the most epic death of any Star Wars character ever. She dies in Obi-Wan's arms.
Did I see this? Is this in Clone Wars, right?
Yeah, you watched all Clone Wars. You definitely did see it. Maul stabs her with the Darksaber to cause Obi-Wan the ultimate suffering, and then she falls onto the ground and dies in Obi-Wan's arms. And she says, her last words were, "Remember, my dear Obi-Wan, I've loved you always. I always will." And it's so great. And that's, I think, was it right before that or during that conversation that he says that he would have left the Jedi Order had she asked? Yeah, it's soul crushing.
How am I not remembering this? I'm having Satine amnesia. Satine.
Skipping ahead. I was like, how does she die?
Well, because I was curious to see, because the reason why I ask is there needs to be more development of Satine.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not seeing any books coming out. And as we speak on this episode in 2023, mm-hmm. Star Wars has a little bit of a pause going on story creation. And
right.
So I'm wondering, are we going to get any Satine deeper story? Do you think that they'll ever explore this? Do you think this is something that's of note to
absolutely.
Them?
Absolutely. I think that with things like Tales of the Jedi coming back for more seasons, I think we are ripe for some Obi-Wan in his younger years on Mandalore protecting Satine with Qui-Gon, and Satine and Obi-Wan's, you know, young relationship blossoming. I think that would be so sick, especially in a short story form where they don't have to dedicate a whole, you know, series or like arcs of a series to it. And then it's out of the timeline in a fitting way. I'd
but
love
to be
that.
Fair, that would then be more about the story of Obi-Wan and not of Satine. Satine
would be
secondary.
Tales of the Jedi. Yeah, but everybody's, we know why we're there. We're there for Satine. They would give us the juicy bits that we want, Al. You know?
Agree
but yeah, she's
disagree.
Dead. that is how we always have to end these things. Okay, so before she died,
yes, because I want to talk about this next thing. So talk about it.
Yeah. So as Satine is trying to reconstruct Mandalore, she faces the most opposition from a group called Death Watch. And you may be familiar with Death Watch if you have watched the Clone Wars series or if you've watched Rebels or any of that stuff. But we see it come up a lot. We also see it come up in The Mandalorian because Bo-Katan was actually a member of Death Watch at this time. So,
explain what Death Watch is.
Okay. So first of all, also Bo-Katan is a Kryze. So it's Bo-Katan Kryze. That is her sister. They are estranged siblings. And Death Watch is basically an extremist group that is the furthest on the violent end of the spectrum as far as the Mandalorian culture goes. So they are the ones that worship the old ways and they hate this new pacifism that Satine is trying to establish. And it's basically just traditionalism, just super dyed-in-the-wool traditionalists, which is actually what Din Djarin is adopted into. What he is a foundling adopted into the Death Watch, which explains a lot of why his belief system is the way that it is. But Bo-Katan
is he
was
adopted
also
into the Death Watch?
Uh huh. It's Death Watch that rescues him during the Night of a Thousand Tears. Yeah.
Okay.
You can see the emblem. It's a Shriekhawk emblem on their shoulder pauldrons that represents Death Watch, and it's 100%. That's why they called him a child of the Watch. They say you were a child of the Watch. That's the Death Watch.
Wait, so this is the thing that's hard, is even somebody who watches all of this stuff, I get
yeah,
rickrolled by it. I mean, so the followers of in the cave system and in the covert,
right,
are those all members of Death Watch? I don't think they are, right?
Well, at this point, they're kind of just dispersed. They are, some of them might have been Death Watch, some of them may have just been traditionalists, but basically things have totally shifted for their culture at this point. But a lot of them were from Death Watch. Death Watch isn't standing strong anymore, because I mean you have, you know, Bo-Katan's crew with like Axe Wolves and
because I thought that the covert that Din Djarin was part of was something that was actually even more how do I say this, traditional than Death Watch, because I think Death Watch was focused more on the warring nature, and Din Djarin's covert is focused more on almost like the religious aspects of right. Mandalorian culture. And
true.
I'm trying to remember what the name of
Grief Karga's planet again, or the town. It's
oh shoot. His original one, or the one he moves to?
The original one where they have the shootout in the alley. Oh shoot, I am blanking. Oh well, we're gonna have to look that up. We might have to leave that one and say that we don't know for sure. But there is a lot of it's a melting pot of Mandalorians. So let's see, where are we? So she gets this opposition from Death Watch. Her strange sister is a part of Death Watch. This is during the neutrality of the Clone Wars as well, which is a lot of conflict with the New Republic, not the New Republic, but just the Republic and the Separatists. So she's getting pressure from all sides. What'd you learn?
I learned Way of the Mandalore. It's actually the religion. Yeah. It is known as the Way of the Mandalore. And it's a religion followed by Orthodox Mandalorians. It involved protecting fellow Mandalorians and taking in foundlings, but also wearing a helmet at all times. The Children of the Watch were a Mandalorian group described by Bo-Katan Kryze as a cult who followed the way and sought to reestablish the religion. So the Children of the Watch
is
not Death Watch. That's the name
of... I misinterpreted that.
Yeah, that's the name of this group, according to Bo-Katan Kryze, is the cult that we see.
Okay.
So again, this is what I love about Mandalorian culture, is we see all of these splinters.
Right.
On someplace like, I don't know, well, let's see. Name a planet. On Naboo, you don't necessarily have all of these splinter cells of Naboo culture. You've got the Naboo culture, and you've got Otogunga. Mm-hmm. And they are separate entities, but they're not like warring amongst each other. On Corellia, you don't necessarily see a bunch of splintered Corellian groups. But with Mandalore, what you see is this rich collision of humanity, and Satine is representing progression, and Bo-Katan is representing tradition, but at the same time then you see Din Djarin is representing dogma, and I think that that is just such a brilliant approach to each one of these. So sorry, it's the Children of the Watch.
That's good.
Is the name of that group.
And it's not related to Death Watch, which is confusing because he was rescued by Death Watch. I know that I saw that emblem on the pauldron, and then he must have been taken in it. I don't know. We'll have to look it up and see. But
yeah. Guys, this is what happens to your hosts when we don't do deep dive research and we just skip a stone across the surface. But
we
again,
are skipping a stone, absolutely.
And I didn't mean to cut you off. You were on a trail there until I went and saw the Wikipedia about.
No, cross the trail. Go for it. I already did.
Oh, Continue on to your brilliant idea.
Our detour. The brilliant idea. Yes. Okay, cool. So, during this civil war, Kenobi and Qui-Gon are on Mandalore protecting Satine because she's got, you know, lots of death threats. People are trying to kill her. People are trying to take her out of power. So the Jedi are there to protect her. That's when they fall in love. Let's see. Some of these notes are out of order.
Well, and one thing that I'm curious about is, can you explain a little bit the relationship between Bo-Katan and Satine? Because in Clone Wars, it's not friendly necessarily.
No, I don't think they've been estranged for years, because they were close when they were young. I read that when they were little and growing up and the relative peaceful times in Mandalore, they were friends. I don't think they've been close or spoken in like years and years and years by the time we see them. In the Clone Wars, they branched off to their own lives completely.
Well, and I think one thing that's really interesting when you explore both of these characters is Satine and Bo-Katan are both very powerful and very, very opinionated and convicted. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that you will notice is a trait across the Mandalorian culture. There is not a Mandalorian who is not convicted or led by their convictions.
Right.
And I think one thing that we have to explore here from a philosophical standpoint is the duality of conviction. For every positive that you get from following a conviction, there's a byproduct of that, and it's not always a positive one, because what if everybody in the world is led by conviction for their own belief? What kind of world does that create?
Yeah.
Is that a really deep, like, anxiety-inducing question?
Yeah, no, I mean, it makes sense, and I think that that's the purpose of how Mandalore is portrayed, is it's fractured. And things fragment, and there's no compromise when you are led solely by conviction that you are unwilling to waver on, you know, which is what we get to see in the show and in all the, you know, the animated shows and the live action shows, is that we're watching people change and watching people change, not because somebody convinced them of something, but because they're witnessing the actions of somebody who believes something completely different than them that they've grown to love or be close with that they respect. And they're like, huh, they believe something totally different. And that's what changes them. Not being convinced of anything through like a logical argument, you know?
Do you think that anybody is changed by Satine's deep conviction?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the entirety of Mandalore has changed. And I think that the fact that she believes...
The entirety?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the people who disagree with her are obviously put into a specific position because their hand is forced to be maybe even more violent than they would have been before by her staunch standings.
So then it's not universally accepted, though, is what
at. Right, yeah, it doesn't change everybody. And she can't just like convince everybody by being nice, but that's part of the story.
I think this is what fascinates me about Star Wars. And again, y'all, this is a very different structure from our traditional episodes. As you can see, this is like our casual cantinas where we're just hanging out,
we're
chatting.
So casual.
Because
two
with
cups
this,
half deep of Al's fallen mother.
She's very chalky right now. Mm-hmm. I think I just need to fill the cup up a little bit more. But with this, the thing that's fascinating to me is to see how culture and humanity is reflected in our art. And that's why I love studying these characters, because when I see the character of Satine, a lot of times we see this as a sympathetic character. But I think that, again, as we always hear in Star Wars, from a different perspective, Satine could be considered a threat to traditionalism and actually be considered a move towards the negative, mm-hmm, instead of the positive. Yeah. Is pacifism all altruistically ideal?
Right.
Is the question that I think that she brings up.
I mean, you think about the survival of a people, and I don't know if it can go that far, that pacifism is a viable option within the world that we live in and the world that they live in Star Wars, full of war and violence, where if you're in charge of other people's well-being, that can be problematic. And I think, you know, you see that because the Republic is unable to protect them because they remain neutral. They don't join the Confederacy or the Republic. So they're completely unaligned. And the only reason that Obi-Wan is there, really, is because he loves her. It's love, mm-hmm, that protects her because of his love for her. It's not necessarily their alignment. So, I mean, that's a danger.
Isn't there a play on that end to be like, well, we're going to see if we can bring them into the Republic? Because they're kind of being courted on both sides.
Yeah.
They're saying, take a side, Mandalore.
Yeah. And, I mean, and Obi-Wan wants Mandalore to join the Republic because it has political, like, leverage and
advantages,
as well as just having another planet that is not a potential enemy, basically, as part of their allies.
Let's also look at it. On the last episode, we compared Mandalorians to Spartans. Mm-hmm. And when you are the Republic, who is it advantageous to not only have another system in the Republic, but also to have a war mastering nation, right, who knows warfare inside and out and who literally worships and breathes it?
Yeah.
And one thing I'm going to just toss this out there.
Let's hear it. I'm fascinated by
is this seeming paradox of approaching or fighting for pacifism, because, mm-hmm, that's what Satine is doing, is she's fighting for pacifism.
Yeah, and
there's that's a paradox right there. That's the perfect example of an ironic paradox.
Yeah, it totally is. And I mean, I think they even make quips about that in the show, but the one time we see Satine and Obi-Wan fighting together, I believe they're fighting droids. So they give Satine a bit of like a moral out with that storyline, because it's on her like her cruise ship, her like cruise yacht thing, when one of her aides is like infiltrating and tries to assassinate her. Do you remember that? Where all the little, they're like the little tiny spider droids that like come out of the
vaguely
food.
Yes,
that was a fun episode. But yeah, exactly. So they're droids that she's fighting. But you're right. I mean, they have to. I mean, even the new Mandalorians were a part of a war between them and the traditionalists. So yeah, it's all over the place. But before we lose the, I hope the thread, this very, very loose gossamer thread of a story is coming across here. But
but remember, we said we weren't gonna, we didn't give anybody any promises about going,
that's
about
true,
going chronologically,
you
through
get
this
what you
listener.
Pay for.
Yeah, exactly. And on an no episode complaints. Like this, we've got to take it like jazz, because again, a character like Satine, you're required to take diversions, and you're required to riff off of a certain topic.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And that's what each one of these characters does for us, is it requires us to dig deeper and
it's
really
true,
kind of figure out where their place in the world matches ours. I think that's totally. One of the biggest things that we get out of art is finding how that character's place in their world informs our own. And so I guess that's a question that I have for you, Michael, on a real world perspective. What do you think that a viewer can take away from the life and storyline of Satine Kreese?
I don't know. I mean, I think that...
Don't irritate your sister.
Yeah, exactly. I think she's inspiring. And I think there's an irony to... Yeah, I don't know if there's anything super simple you could take away from her life, but it's the
believe in yourself.
It's interesting in the complexity. Yeah.
Trust your gut.
But I'm thinking about the irony between the Jedi, which are really built on like Buddhist and Hindu beliefs, and a lot of those beliefs are super pacifist, or even Jainism, which is extremely pacifist, and they're the ones fighting all the wars. All the wars are the Jedi. And Satine talks about this all the time. Like, for a peacekeeper, you light up, you bring your lightsaber, you know, too often. She's making jokes at his expense all the time, just about the fact that you're a peacekeeper, but you are fighting wars for like the Senate. It doesn't make any sense. So I do love that she brings out that kind of contrast in the Jedi and how she's living more like a Jedi than the Jedi are, at least at this point in time. And it's not totally working. And like, and people, what's up?
Oh no. So I was trying to make meaning out of that and saying that really one of the things that you can gather out of that is always take stock of your motivation. What is your reason for doing what you're doing? And I think that it's easy for us to, as all human beings, to get on a path where we're just like, well, of course we believe this. This is what we're doing. This is why we're going this direction. And I think that a lot of times we can get mired and lost in the activity and forget why we are motivated to do what we are motivated to do at the heart of it. And I think that that's something that Satine makes us question all the time is, again, just like with Obi-Wan being like, you say you are this, but do your actions reflect who you say you are? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a huge, huge thing to draw from what Satine brings to the table.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. She's really interesting. She's one of my favorite Clone Wars characters. And I love the story arcs that have her in them. Because, yeah, they do make you think. And it's interesting to see this super rich culture kind of play off of each other. Because there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of deep stuff in the Clone Wars, as anybody who's watched it a little bit knows. I mean, there's a like a terrorist bomber in one of the first episodes that we meet Satine, where he throws himself off of a ledge and dies instead of being captured by Satine and her men. And he like has some he says some phrase in like the ancient Mandalorian tongue about war being their way of life or something, and then dies there like in the city center. It's like, oh my gosh.
You know what's amazing?
Fanfare.
I feel like we have all met a Mandalorian. We've all met Mandalorians in our lives, those people who are just so convicted about everything. Right. And sometimes you just want to be like, you just need to go to a lower frequency, bruh. Because if you keep up there, you're gonna have a meltdown.
Yeah, because I do think it's interesting what you bring up about conviction is the main thread among Mandalorian people.
Because I think I think it's universal. Universally, we see that Mandalorians are convicted by, or I should say, are led by their convictions.
Yeah, which is really interesting. I mean, look at how much turmoil the Darksaber has caused just because of its like meaning in their history. Like, what does the Darksaber mean to them? And it just rips them apart because they can't decide, you know, who is the leader? How do you have to attain it? Does it have to be through combat? All these things. Yeah, it's all... Yeah, they're all very convicted about how they do things, making sure they do things the right way, you know, that Bo-Katan wouldn't accept the Darksaber without winning it in combat. And like, yeah, they make their lives complicated.
The amazing thing is, I think that Here's the truth, friends. As you hear this, a lot of people have never watched The Clone Wars, probably, who are listening to this episode. This should give you reason. Even if you're somebody who's not into animated anything, don't watch it because it's animated. Watch it because it is it's a larger, how do I say this? A larger canvas for the artists to paint on. You get so much more story in the Sistine Chapel's ceiling than you do in the Mona Lisa, simply because there's more space to explore. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of the Clone Wars, is we're looking at the Sistine Chapel, whereas Star Wars A New Hope is the Mona Lisa. They're both masterpieces in their own right. But yeah, the beauty of the Clone Wars is every single corner provides something new, incredible, and deep, not only to Star Wars lore, but for us as human beings to be able to glean from. And that's where I think that, again, Dave Filoni and George Lucas are absolute geniuses, because they take this thing that a lot of people think are just for kids, and they turn it into something that is philosophically deeper than probably most things that we will encounter in our lives.
Oh, for sure, yeah. Yeah, and sometimes it's packaged in a simple episode.
Yeah.
But it leaves you thinking about things afterwards. And the payoff of how all the stories intertwine towards the end is amazing. It's unsurpassed. It's so good. Once you get into the 5th, 6th, and 7th seasons of the Clone Wars, it's just cranked to 11 the entire time. It's so awesome.
It's incredible. I highly recommend it. Oh, look at that.
We've double highly recommended, guys. Okay. So, so Bo-Katan eventually leaves the Death Watch because Death Watch is taken over by none other than Darth Maul. So Darth Maul sees an opportunity to consolidate power. He kind of, once he survives his whole trash heap planet cut in half, he finds his brother. He's got a whole lot of family. He's just got issues.
Spider legs.
He gets real. He gets normal legs. As he's working through all his problems, he decides that he wants to consolidate power in the criminal underworld and basically bring down the Emperor. He has two vendettas. It's against the Emperor and then his lifelong vendetta against Kenobi. So gaining power and military is very valuable to him. So he consolidates all of these criminal underworlds. That includes, you know, the Hutts. That includes Dryden Voss's group with the Crimson Dawn, the Pikes, you know, all these different syndicates, whatever.
He's creating a militia of sorts.
A militia, yeah, exactly. And the Death Watch is a part of that as well. So he gets the Death Watch. He manages to... I forgot exactly how he gets his hands on the Darksaber. I think he must have killed somebody for the Darksaber. But he has the Darksaber, which, again, thinking about the conviction of these Mandalorians, because Maul has the Darksaber, they all, like, most of them accept him as their leader.
Blindly
follow.
Even though
he's not... Yeah, even though he's not a true Mandalorian. And Bo-Katan and a fragment of people that stand with her aren't willing to accept him as an actual Mandalorian leader, regardless of the Darksaber. So that's why she defects from Death Watch, eventually going to free her sister from imprisonment. But she is quickly recaptured by Maul. And that is where Maul brings Kenobi, because he'd captured Kenobi as well. Maul brings Kenobi and Satine into this main throne room area, and that's where he ends up killing Satine in front of Kenobi, because he just wants to cause him the ultimate suffering, and he leaves Kenobi alive to basically, like, wallow in his suffering. Which, that scene, oh, that scene's so good.
That's a cruelty. A cruelty indeed.
Such a cruelty. Yeah, so that's how she dies. That's how Bo-Katan is kind of re-endeared. Like, she connects with her sister again right there towards the end, and then continues on, you know, the good path, as we see in The Mandalorian and as she works with Ahsoka, and we see a lot more of her story unfold. But yeah, that was kind of the turning point for her leaving the Death Watch, where she was, you know, more of a bad guy.
But the interesting thing is, I would never say that Bo-Katan ever aligns herself with her sister's ideals.
No, she totally disagrees with it, with all the things she believes, but she loves her and, you know, obviously doesn't believe in the pure, unadulterated violence and chaos that Maul and, you know, the Shadow Collective and Death Watch is trying to bring.
Well, and that's where I as we talk about this, one thing I want us to think about is this name Satine. Mm-hmm. Satine is a unique name. I've never I've only heard it one other time used.
Yeah.
I've never met anybody named Satine.
Yeah.
But it reminds us. So before we do this, Michael, you've got a note about this. Where do we also hear the name Satine?
In Moulin Rouge.
I
literally cannot talk about Satine Kryze without bringing up Moulin Rouge. I love Moulin Rouge, first of all. If you haven't seen that, go ahead and pause. Pause this episode and go watch Moulin Rouge if you haven't seen it. Yeah, dude, I've seen Moulin Rouge like 5 times. It's amazing.
I never would have guessed that you liked Moulin Rouge. And you know why I never would have guessed that? Because I really love Moulin Rouge.
Oh, 'cause you love Moulin Rouge, dude, yes! We can agree on something. Okay, let's get into Moulin Rouge for the next hour and a half.
Break this down. Do you think that there's a connection? Do you think that there's
without a doubt. It is 100% inspired by this. So in Moulin Rouge, Ewan McGregor, whose character's name is Christian, is in love with Nicole Kidman, whose character's name is Satine. Literally the same exact spelling, exact same character name. And they have this romance that they fall in love and get to spend a super short amount of time together, and then she dies of tuberculosis, I think.
Yes,
and she dies in Christian's arms, in Ewan McGregor's arms. And that scene where she dies in his arms is so similar to Satine's death scene in The Clone Wars as well. And they're both, you know, Kenobi, basically, Ewan McGregor. There's an undoubtedly a connection between the two, which is super fun.
But. Well, and you want to know the great part is that Ewan McGregor part. That he is the voice of Obi-Wan. Well, he's the character of Obi-Wan, but not in the show.
Yeah, exactly.
But he's the character of Obi-Wan, and he's then Christian. I love that.
Totally.
That is an amazing observation. Well, and one thing that I want to think, I want to settle on with that is I can't imagine that they named her Satine just because they were like, okay, we're going to get this death scene that references this movie from the way early 2000s.
Right, yeah, exactly.
I mean, that has to be maybe part of it as an in-joke. But at the same time, when we think of the name Satine, what's the other thing that you think of right after that?
Crackers. Saltine crackers.
Oh, interesting. Is that really what you think of first?
Yes.
Because the first
of?
Thing that I think of is satin.
Satin. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
A smooth, glossy fabric produced by a weave in which the threads of the wrap are caught and looped by the weft only at certain intervals. The interesting thing is...
The wads of the web are caught by the weft at certain intervals. I love it.
Listen to this. It's not durable as it tends to snag.
Right.
It's one of the three fundamental types of textile weaves alongside plain and twill.
Now, it is extremely pacifist.
The thing is, think about this. Was the pacifism that Satine produced in Mandalore, was it durable? Did it endure?
For quite a while, it could have worked.
Did it endure, Michael?
Yes. No, I know. I want to just disagree with you.
It didn't even last 20 years.
We'd have to. Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
It was insane-o short. It was insane-o short, if you think about it. Because, again, we look at Bo-Katan's interactions in The Mandalorian, which we then see the remains of Mandalore in that show.
Right.
Which take place roughly what?
I don't think there was any hope. Mandalore would have never, it didn't matter. Her pacifism isn't the reason that the Empire glassed Mandalore. They glassed Mandalore because they're too much of a threat. They literally couldn't be left standing by the Empire.
I disagree. I think that the pacifism.
What could they have done? They could have aligned with, like, what would they have done? They couldn't do anything to save them from that fate.
See, I don't know. I guess I look at it and say that whether or not they could or couldn't have done anything, it didn't endure because that rain couldn't endure. I mean, the reality of human beings, no matter how we want to look at it, is whether it, I think maybe philosophically we could have a different argument, but when we look at realistic culture, that's one thing that you're looking up right now. This is exactly what I wanted to talk about. Is
right,
are there any societies that have successfully worked through pacifism? And I think maybe some people would argue like Sweden maybe is a good example of successful pacifism, but yeah. Even Sweden has an army.
What about Finland, where the name of the planet came from?
Ooh, is Finland pacifist?
I don't know. Let's search Finland. They seem like it. The three fingers of the north, you know? They all
I
seem
don't know
super...
what that means.
I just made that up. I don't know. Finland, Sweden, Norway, you know?
Three fingers of the north.
The three fingers of the north.
I am curious if Sweden is pacifist, ooh, because if it is, or is... I mean, Finland.
Oh, yeah. Could be.
And I could go for some poutine right
poutine.
Now.
Poutine. I'm thinking poutine. Satine also makes me think of poutine.
But also, what kind of people wear satin? Is it the commoner? No, it is the royalty. Yeah. Royal satin. Ooh. Is.
Yeah, I'll let you keep going.
No,
about
no,
satin.
I can't. I'm not going to stop an ooh. Okay. You've got an ooh there. I need to.
Just waxing poetic about satin. I love it.
So I wait, what were you excited about?
I was just going to say. Speaking of royalty, remember our boy Ian McCaig?
Yes.
Who was the originator of the look of Darth Maul?
Yes.
So he also did concept art for Padme Amidala for episode 1 that was unused, and Satine is based off of some of his unused concepts for Padme, which is kind of cool.
Oh, interesting.
We didn't have that much time to get into behind the scenes stuff, but
yeah, there's a lot of headdress similarities.
There's a lot of headdress, yeah. A lot of headdressage. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, I just am really fascinated by the fact I always love the significance of name choice.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree.
And in Star Wars, the fact that his name is Darth Maul, Maul being bad in Spanish. I mean, right. it's very, very on the nose sometimes. The noise. And I think that Satine's name represents a lot about her character. That it's seemingly it's soft. She's soft in the way that she not like she's not soft as a person, but mm-hmm. she's able to soften the hardened edges of Obi-Wan Kenobi, and it's not a durable fabric, so it doesn't endure. And as we can see, unfortunately, her best intentions are lead to kind of the ruin there, which I find is very fascinating.
Yeah. It is. I just pulled up a little something about the name here too. So this is funny. Gilroy, who created her name, denied that Satine was named after Nicole Kidman's character in Moulin Rouge, who was the love interest of Ewan McGregor's character. In response, Dave Filoni said he did not realize this at first and stated, "I still want to question Gilroy about that because I'm like, come on, really? I mean, out of all the names, really? It's pretty weird. I'll give you that." So even Dave Filoni doesn't believe that it wasn't named after Moulin Rouge. It totally was.
It's a very interesting name because I think that's like the only other place that Satine exists.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
You know what I love, listener, is the fact that Michael and I were very staunch on the fact that these are going to be short 30-minute episodes. We're an hour and 5 minutes in.
Hour and 5 minutes. Okay, well, is there any big bullet points we want to... Like, anything we didn't talk about with Satine that we want to talk about?
I mean, the thing that I think is apparent here is you cannot talk about Bo-Katan, you cannot talk about Din Djarin without bringing up Satine. And so I think that
good choices.
Only our next two episodes will help us find more that we may not have covered
more
on
to
this
talk
episode.
About.
Yes.
I like it. And those will be 30 minutes, maybe 39 minutes. We're going to make it happen.
Satine has like six episodes in the Clone Wars. If that's the case, if we're looking at this in a ratio, then each of these next two episodes is going to be 3.5 hours apiece.
All right, we're going to record them, and then what we're going to do is we're going to speed them up so they're all exactly 30 minutes, no matter what. And then you just listen to us at whatever speed it happens to be.
Fair enough. I think that's a good way to hit that goal.
Well, Al, do you want to... look, my calf is empty. Do you want to? Should we close it out? Do you want
to close this one out? I think it's a good place. I mean, I think that what we see with Satine is Satine Kryze is an extremely complex character, though she may not have gotten the main character spotlight shown upon her yet. We do see through this exploration that she's worthy of a main character exploration, and it's our hope that she does get that opportunity down the line, because her complexities only reflect our own complexities. Her conflicts only reflect our own conflicts, and her convictions only reflect our own convictions. But even in that, it helps challenge us to say, when do we stay convicted and when do we learn to compromise for the sake of the greater good? And with all these things, we realize that Satine Kryze is an extremely complex, dynamic, engaging, and just downright awesome character. So with that, folks, go watch The Clone Wars. Learn more about Satine. Amen. And seeking more of learning about things, you can learn more about this and all of our other episodes of this show over at smugglersdispatch.com, our website. Our good old droid buddy CB has put together show notes, links, pictures, and more for you to peruse at your leisure. Over on Instagram and YouTube, you can find us at Smuggler's Dispatch. It's always weird. You can find us at.
Doesn't roll off the tongue.
Yeah. But go search Smuggler's Dispatch over there, and you can follow us on Instagram and see stuff when we release it every once in a while on YouTube.
Yes, yeah, we'll see how that goes. But also, we want to hear from you guys. So ratings and even better reviews on Apple Podcasts and Spotify are hugely helpful to our show. And Al, actually, I don't know if you've seen this, where certain episodes on Spotify have this option to like comment. It'll say like, what did you think about this episode? Or what did you think about the show? So I don't know if those are... if they're kind of trying out A/B testing reviews or something like that. So if you see one of those pop up, just say what's up.
I think that's more algorithmic. Don't
algorithmic.
You?
Well, if you guys get algorithmically chosen, then put something nice in there. That'd be fun. But obviously you can always review us on Apple Podcasts, etc.
Interesting. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Keep an eye out for that on other podcasts you listen to. It's interesting.
And people can leave us voicemails, right?
Oh, yeah. We want to hear your sultry tones on the Smuggler's Dispatch. So head over to smugglersdispatch.com and click the little microphone icon in the bottom right, and you can leave us a voicemail. So feel free to ask us a question, tell a story, whatever you want to share with us, and the HoloNet. Our next episode is going to be about either Din Djarin or Bo-Katan.
Bo-Katan.
I don't know what order. Okay, Bo-Katan. Our next one's about Bo-Katan. So if you got Mandalorian questions... Send them in, and we would love to feature those on the show, and we'll try to answer any questions. We'll beat around the bush and figure something out to say. We always do. So with that, thank you guys for tuning in. May the Force be with you.
And may the stars light your way.